Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name, you will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
Hey everybody, welcome in, it's David Summers, and here we go with another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. This is the story of wrestling in America, as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So now, let's step back into the ring, back into time. Let's get wall to wall. Tree top tall with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Hey, Ron, on the last Studcast, you became even more a historian than previously recognized, opening the podcast with a ton of information about Hurricane Helene. Actually, your numbers were pretty much right on it, as in as the past week has shown. Your prediction of it being one of the worst hurricanes ever in this country was probably correct as well, because it has really been a mess.
Oh, boy. And, you know, my thoughts and prayers, man, still go out to everyone affected by Hurricane Helene, especially those in eastern Tennessee, close to where I live, and even more so maybe the western side of the Carolinas where they really got bombed.
Man, it's unbelievable when you see it on TV and the pictures and the video. I know for sure, looking at the numbers, listening to the last Studcast and judging from the response, they were eager to hear your thoughts on the tragedy, especially since it appeared Helene was moving. It appeared it was moving toward your Georgia family members and then headed possibly for you where you are in eastern Tennessee. So now Uncle Milton is moving in. So I have to ask, where's your brother Rob and what's his status? Because he lives there in St. Pete, in the St. Pete area.
Oh, it's just crazy, isn't it, man? I can't imagine. And last week we're talking about Hurricane Helene. And today, as we're recording this, my brother's moving inland, man, and trying to get away from one that's maybe going to be worse than Helene, possibly.
Yeah.
Especially if it gets into Tampa. Tampa is a very low-lying city, and population there is massive. I mean, it's crazy what's going on with the hurricanes. That's for darn sure.
Hey, you know, I had the wonderful opportunity to visit with you in your home when you lived in that area. So where, compared to where you once lived, does your brother Rob live?
He lived only about 2 miles from me.
Wow.
And he's going to be going to stay with his daughter and her husband. And they live about 10 miles inland from the beach, from Clearwater Beach, basically.
Yeah, that's good. And you were not far from the beach at all. You were only like less than a mile from the beach, right?
Yeah. I was fairly close to the beach, yeah. So, he's getting a little bit away from it. I hope he's getting far enough away from it, I guess what I say.
Yeah, they say it took a little bit of a jog to the south, and that's good. So it is between Tampa and Sarasota, more towards Bradenton, Florida, if you want to see it on a map. So fortunately, and fortunately, they were concerned that Tampa Bay was really going to swell and possibly 10 to 12, even 15 feet of water would move into Tampa and that part of Florida. So fortunately, they're now saying that that is not going to be the case, and hopefully it's going to be a little bit south of there. So hopefully we'll continue to keep those folks in our thoughts and prayers, and especially Rob. All right, so Stud, we've got a lot to do today. Where are we going to be riding today? And don't forget, by the way, about the Sweet Brown Sugar and Ricky Gibson incident, right?
I know you weren't going to forget about that one, Dave. But we're going to discuss it in this studcast. And for those that might not have heard the last studcast, we had a most unusual problem between Brown Sugar, Sweet Brown Sugar, and Ricky Gibson. And Brown Sugar, whose real name was Skip Young, decided to take his dislike of Gibson up a notch, man, and then went to the ring without our permission and attacked Ricky in the middle of a match he was having with Billy Spears. And then Ricky, in the very next match, which was a Brown Sugar match, he kind of returned the pain, I guess is a good way of putting it. He went and attacked Brown Sugar. Each one of them ended up with busted eyes, man.
Wow.
And as I said before in last week, we're going to cover that incident for sure. And after that, I'm going to take us where the fans have gone, have really never gone. We're going to go deep inside the business, man, where so much was happening during this time frame. It was not only going to affect our territory, but the Georgia territory as well. Then we're going to break down another great card in a territory that was really kicking butt at this time. This week's card is going to be the fourth week in a row that we filled all of our buildings, and which was absolutely amazing for September. Traditionally, a month that was very difficult for sports events to be able to draw much of anybody. Summer had ended at this point. Kids were back in school. And that usually meant a drop in attendance. But boy, it didn't happen this year in 1980. We'll cover the great third week in September, Southeastern's card. Mm-hmm. We've got a tremendous seven-match card with two loser-leave matches plus three championship matches on it. And finally, we're going to break down another great TV show. We'll give everybody the results of the matches on that weekly card. We'll talk about the attendances for the three major markets. And hopefully, Dave, we're going to have a chance for a learning tree question again.
After all that, okay, we'll see if we can work that in. Every studcast nowadays, it seems like it's always filled with facts and history, which you're kind of famous for now. So I've been looking forward to hearing about that shoot between Ricky Gibson and Sweet Brown Sugar since last week. So now you tell us you're going to take us inside the business itself. So I don't know which one to look forward to the most. With all this new information, where are you going to begin this whole ordeal today?
Well, let's start, man, with my first time ever to experience an incident between two wrestlers that just didn't like each other, I guess is a good way of putting it. That's all I could figure out. Sweet Brown Sugar and Ricky Gibson, I'm talking about. Sadly, both of those guys were great wrestlers. And Dave, they both passed at this point. Man, I can't believe that.
Wow.
Wow, that's strange. And obviously, they're no longer with us. But we're going to talk about what happened in this. And they arrived in the territory, basically the two of them, 1 week apart in June of 1980. And I think that's where the problems began with each other, maybe right away. But it could have started in another territory before they even came to Southeastern. And I might not have known that. No wrestling, that wasn't the type of thing that wrestlers or promoters talked about a lot to each other if they had a problem like that. Mm-hmm. So either way, in the last studcast, Ricky Gibson was going to be wrestling Billy Spears in the first match on the card. And Skip Young, who's Sweet Brown Sugar's name, decided on his own to basically go and attack Gibson during his match with Spears. And he whacked Ricky with a pretty good shot, busted Ricky's eye, busting him a hard way. And so in the next match, it was between Sweet Brown Sugar and against Norvell Austin. Ricky Gibson decided, well, I'm going to go do to him what he did to me. And he went to the ring and he busted Skip's eye.
Wow. So. All right. I mean, have you ever seen anything like that before, Stud?
No. Not as an owner, man, you know, and I'd never seen anything like that before, period. So I saw a little bit of stiffness in both of those guys in the first match that I put them together when they got there. And that was about a month before this altercation. But I didn't think a whole lot about it, you know. In fact, I even booked them against each other the very next week because, you know, I said, hey, well, that was pretty cool. I mean, you know, I mean, they got just mad enough that they didn't go to really whacking each other. But, wow, the fans were really into it. So I watched their match the next week, and I kind of saw it again, you know. But it got to be worse in that second match, and I decided not to have them wrestle each other anymore because I didn't want that kind of problem to get started in our territory. That's not a good thing to have happen. And after all, if I could stop it, why wouldn't I, you know? And I definitely could. Mm-hmm. So when I saw what happened on this last card between them, where they just went after each other, not even booked against each other, I invited them to come to my home, man. And I said, you know, I'd like to sit down with both you guys, and I want to try to help you work out whatever problem it is that you guys are at.
Wow.
So you know, and I thought that was a great way to handle it. So at that point, they both arrived at my house. They had busted eyes, and both their eyes were black and swollen, you know. And so I got to thinking when I looked at them, I said, you know, my granddad and my father, I said, they would have probably encouraged this type of thing, you know, because they thought that was good for business. When fans saw guys that had real busted eyes, you know, that was what they wanted to get. They would like to see that happen, you know. But the problem was it was real, and that wasn't what those two guys needed, and it certainly wasn't what we wanted to, or we expected to have in our territory.
Wow. I mean, so you're like doing some counseling between the two. Really fascinating. So this type of thing couldn't have happened much. I mean, did it? And how did you deal with it? What do you do when two guys come over with busted eyes? Hey, you want to flip some steaks, boys? I mean, what'd you do?
Well, you know, it didn't happen much. No, I can tell you that. I was in wrestling a long time. I would have seen it before. You know, this is totally new for me, man. So I kind of came up with a unique way to deal with this problem. You know, and I kind of thought about what they might be going to say when I got them there. So I told them that the territory owners had decided that we were going to let you guys settle your differences in the ring in a shoot match, with the winner staying and the loser of the match got to leave the territory.
Wow.
And so, you know, and I said, and if you agree, both of you are going to be invited back to work here, but never again in the same crew.
Wow. Okay.
So I threw that on them. And then I said, you know, guys, I'm going outside to my pool. And I said, you guys come and get me when you decide what you want to do about this, if you want to settle it maybe in a little different way than I have just suggested.
Okay, so you sort of left them in the den together to work this thing out. So what did they say to that?
Well, about a half hour later, man, they called me back inside, right? And they apologized for the problem that they had created and, you know, what they'd done to each other. You know, they had made apologies to each other, I guess, at that point. And they agreed, you know, to have the loser leave match, but they said, but we're definitely not going to have a shoot, right? They weren't going to do that, right? And they decided that Skip Young was going to be the guy that was going to be leaving, and that Ricky Gibson was going to be staying there because that was his home. That's where he was born and raised, and his family all lived there. So they decided, you know, that Ricky's going to win, obviously, and stay, and Brown Sugar was going to leave the day after the loser leaves match. So I told them, you know, I was proud of them, man, and I really was, you know, that they had worked this out together. And I told Skip, you know, because he was going to leave, you know, and he didn't have a place to go. He takes a couple of weeks to get into another territory.
Yeah.
I told Skip that we're going to give him $2,000 as a leaving bonus to cover all of his expenses until he got to go to work in a new territory.
Wow.
And obviously Ricky was very happy with the situation because he was going to get to stay in his hometown with his family.
All right. That's a great compromise. I mean, between the two of them, and a very creative plan by you to make it happen. So, but $2,000, it was not like severance pay, but I mean, that was a lot of money in 1980.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, that's probably, I haven't looked up the figure, but it's probably $4,000 or $5,000 at least.
Yeah.
You know, it was a nice gesture, and it was great that these guys worked it out like that.
Yeah, and so I mean, so Sweet Brown Sugar had to be somewhat relieved that okay, if I'm gonna leave, I'm leaving in pretty good shape. Wow. All right, so it's time now for that deep dive into what was really going on at this time behind the scenes of Southeastern. Is that what you want to do now?
Yeah, you know, and I mean, wow, I mean, this thing that we're about to talk about now is takes things to a whole new level, man. I mean, so much was going on at this time in Southeastern in 1980. And so I think all of this is going to be fascinating to the fans, especially what we're about to discuss here. So let's begin explaining this by going through a short history of the people that had been bookers. In my Southeastern territories, especially down there on the Gulf Coast, for the first 2.5 years that it had been a territory there. So we opened up on my 30th birthday on March the 3rd, 1978, was our very first match we ever had in the Southeastern Gulf Coast territory as Southeastern Wrestling. And so Bob and I booked the territory from the time it opened until December of 1978. And then Rob took over the booking then, but ended up leaving unexpectedly the following month. He took that job booking for the Memphis territory, where my father and Jarrett were, right? So Bob went home to Georgia when that happened, because he had been there long enough to realize that this thing is going to work. And he was committed to selling his house in Marietta that he had forever, and to return back to Pensacola and to buy a new home there and make that his residency for the rest of his career. Mm. So I gave Louis Tillett the Southeastern Gulf Coast booking job in February of 1979 when Rob left and went to Memphis. So Louis booked during that whole year. That's when he discovered Hulk Hogan, and you know, it had a pretty decent summer of that year. And Louis was then replaced by Robert in October of 1979 after the Memphis deal had fallen apart. And so it was the same month in 1979 that I sold Southeastern Knoxville to the Georgia promoters. Exactly 5 years, imagine that, after I started Southeastern, I sold out in the same month of October.
Yeah.
So after my sale in Knoxville, Bob and I, we both ended up back in Pensacola. Rob and I together had booked the South. We started booking the Southeastern Gulf Coast territory for that year, from basically October 1979 all the way into October of 1980. And that's where we are in this studcast here with that card for the third week in October of 1980.
Okay, so, I mean, this had really been an excellent history lesson about Southeastern Gulf Coast booker history. And knowing you, you are going to be headed to something very special about now. What's that going to be?
Yeah, I mean, this is crazy. It gets crazy from here. So I wanted basically to do this, refresh your memory of the fans about these years and let them know that we had been booking in my territories. Because there was another, we had at this point right now in 1980, another huge booking change coming. And so this kind of leads us back to another Georgia promoter's problem. After their sale of Southeastern Knoxville to Ric Flair and Blackjack Mulligan in October 1980, that brings us up to where we are. Now Georgia promoters are no longer in Knoxville. They have sold out to Ric Flair and Blackjack Mulligan. And so I don't know what was going on internally in the Georgia territory. It had two owners down there, Jim Barnett and Fred Ward. I don't know what was going on at that time, but Jim Barnett fired his booker, Ole Anderson, just about the same time in October of 1980. And it could have had something to do with the Knoxville deal and how it had failed. I mean, Barnett and Fred Ward didn't expect that deal to fail. They thought they would just go in there and take over the problem that I was having with the Knoxville War, and then everything would be rosy. They'd make a lot of money. Didn't happen. So I had sold the company a year earlier, but what came next was my business. And, it wasn't any of my business, basically, what happened in Georgia. They had bought the territory from me. What came next, man, was definitely my business. And it was my partner's business. And what happened next is Jim Barnett offered Ole Anderson's booker job to my brother, Robert.
Wait, he did what? I mean, he wanted to make your brother, Robert, his booker. I mean, shouldn't he have talked to you about this before offering Robert the job? I mean, to me, it sounds a little like the Memphis deal a year or so earlier.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, obviously, man. It was a very bad deal. I mean, it should have never happened that way. So it turned out the same person responsible for Rob, in when he went to Memphis to become the booker there in early 1979, had recommended Robert again to his good friend and his former partner in Australia, Jim Barnett.
All right, if I remember correctly, the man that did that in Memphis was your father. Your father, Bobby Fuller. So surely he didn't do that to you again.
Oh, he certainly did, man. But this time, you know, it wasn't going to be as bad for us as it was in 1979, at least. When Rob left in 1979, he took a whole lot of the Southeastern Gulf Coast talent with him to Memphis, right? And We struggled down in that territory big time throughout that year that Louis Tillette was down there as the booker, because he took Mongolian Stomper, he took Tony Charles, he took Jimmy Golden, he took Kevin. I mean, he took a whole lot of guys into Memphis that shouldn't have gone there. So there's a whole lot more to this story, Dave, a heck of a lot. But we got a tremendous card and a great TV show that's still coming in the rest of this studcast. And I hate to do this, but I think we're going to have to come back to this subject next week in the next studcast. And we better jump on what we got going in this one if we're going to get through it.
Yeah, it sounds like this wagon is loaded down with what you already have, as opposed to bringing up some new stuff. And as you said, before you started this story, it was going to be fascinating, and it certainly is. I can hardly wait until next week to hear the rest. So before we take our break, why don't you give us this week's Southeastern card? We're in the third week of September 1980. Set all that up for us, Stud.
Well, in the opening match, Roy Lee Welch was facing a very familiar mask wrestler, to everybody down in that part of the country, he was extremely familiar. And that guy was called the Super Pro. We'll talk a little bit more about, quite a bit more about this guy before it's over. Charlie Cook was wrestling Plowboy Frazier, who was obviously seconded by his, at this point, bald-headed Floyd. And third match was going to be one of two loser leaves Southeastern matches on the card. The one I talked about earlier here, Sweet Brown Sugar, was going up against Ricky Gibson.
Yeah.
Loser was going to be leaving.
Yeah.
Then in a special challenge match, after what Ron Bass had done to help the Big C win the Southeastern Tag Championship belts, he was going to be dealing one-on-one with the guy that he caused to lose, who was at this point a very angry dude, and you didn't want to have an angry Bob Armstrong. Fifth match was the Texas Death Match for the Southeastern Championship with the Big C, who was barred from ringside for this one. And I was going after the champion, Mongolian Stomper. Then there was a new Southeastern Tag Champion, Big C, 1 and 2. They were going to be defending against Joe LaDuke, This time Joe had a new partner, and his partner was going to be Rob. Then in the last match, which was the second loser leave event of the night, the winner was going to be the new United States Junior Heavyweight Champion, and the loser was going to be leaving Southeastern. Tony Charles was taking on the champion, Jerry Stubbs.
Wow, you were not kidding about this card being tremendous. That's really good. I noticed in the first match, you had a masked wrestler calling himself Super Pro. Could that have been possibly Randy Rose returning again under a mask after getting beat in the Loser Leaves pole match against Bob Armstrong 2 weeks earlier? How about that for a guess? Plus, there were three championship matches and two Loser Leaves matches. So we're at a good spot. Let's take a break. And when we come back after the break, we're going to be talking about another loaded TV show. That is happening when this Studcast continues. Hey, Studcast fans, David Summers, and I just want to let you know how much we appreciate your support every week and the fact that in the past couple of months, the number of fans listening to each Studcast has really almost doubled, and that is fantastic. It has proven to Ron that the support is there for something special. A huge gift to all listeners is in the process. It could take what he does to an entirely new level. He's working on it right now and has been for weeks. If it happens, it'll make what he does for his fans truly remarkable. Stay tuned for more each week. Okay, Studcast fans, welcome back in episode number 369. That's 369 weeks of the Studcast. This episode is called Tony Charles Gone, Rob Georgia Booker. All right, Stud, it is time for your weekly breakdown of the TV show promoting the great card that you just set up for us right before the break. So lay it out for us. How did the TV show open up?
Well, this one began with Charlie at the set, as always. It was a close-up shot of him by himself. And he made a special announcement, which was great news for Southeastern fans. He announced that coming soon, Don Curtis had managed to corral not just one or two world champions, but three world champions for the same event. And there was a new NWA World Heavyweight Champion that had just won the title just a week or two before this television show in 1980. And that was Harley Race had defeated Terry Funk to win the World Junior Heavyweight Championship. So he said, obviously he mentioned that. And then he said also that this event was going to include Les Thornton, the World Junior Heavyweight Champion, and the World's Lady Champion, Fabulous Moolah. So hearing this news, the studio audience, gosh, they exploded, man. And that was Charlie's first line in the show. Right? So, I mean, that's getting the show off the heck of a start. Fans in the studio just went crazy, like, gee, what is this all about? So when the cameras backed away, there sat Bob Armstrong sitting next to Charlie. And Bob didn't look very happy, I'm telling you. So they briefly discussed his and Joe LeDuc's loss of the Southeastern tag belts. Basically, it was in their very first title defense. They lost their belts to Big C's 1 and 2. And then then Charlie asked Bob, he said, would you like to see exactly how that loss happened? You know, because there was somebody in that involved in this that made it happen, basically. And Bob told him, basically, he said, I've been waiting for this moment for an entire week, Charlie. You're darn right I want to see this myself. So Charlie asked Wayne Register, the director, to roll the tape. And it showed, started out with Joe LeDuc and Big C fighting outside the ring on the concrete. And it showed the referee laying face down on the canvas. He had been accidentally knocked down. He had crashed with one of the two guys that was still in the ring. And at that point, Bob Armstrong had a sleeper hold on Big C, too. And basically, this match was over. I mean, you know, nobody got out of Bob's sleeper. And,
wow.
So then all of a sudden, here comes Big Ron Bass. He's got his bull rope, and he came into the ring behind Bob's back. Bob never saw him at all. And Bass on last week's TV had promised basically to everybody that that he was going to get even for his former partner, Randy Rose, having gotten beat by Bob Armstrong and having to leave Southeastern Wrestling. And he was going to take care of business, basically. And he basically did exactly that. And so he really decided the outcome of this championship match. So, you know, Bob's got the sleeper hold and the Bass has got his big bull rope and he nailed Bob in the back of the head with that big old steel cowbell, man, which attached to his bull rope and knocked Bob out. He went down face first, referee's laying there too. And so Bass rolled him over and Bob, and onto his back, he pulled a big C2 over on top of him and he left the ring. Referee was still kind of basically down. The referee then finally crawled over, and Bass is back in the dressing room by that point, and he rolled over and he counted Bob out. So at this point, Bob watched it again, and for the first time, and he goes, wow. He was so mad when Charlie said, what did you think, Bob? He was just shaking his head from side to side. He really, you could tell he did. He was so mad. I was afraid he was going to say something that we were going to have to bleep out, right? So so Ron Bass happened to be on the first match of this day. So Charlie sees that, you know, he's pretty angry, and he says, well, Baba, he goes, our first match today is Ron Bass, and would you like to be here and sit here with me and make some comments on this? So, and about the first thing out of Bob's mouth was, "I sure would." So Ron Bass came bouncing up into the ring, man. They pointing over there at Bob, and he was laughing at him, you know, about what he had just watched that went on and how he had cost him the tag team championship. And you know, Bass was a big old strong son of a gun, and he didn't have any mercy on his TV opponents. And in less than a minute, he had this guy hanging over his shoulder, and he gave him one of those rides across the ring, jumped in the air and crashed down on him with 300 pounds. And,
wow,
that powerful old Texas Stampede of his was, a devastating move. So, and Bob didn't have time really to say hardly anything, you know? So at this point, Bass, you know, he slams on top of the guy, and then Bob gets up and he goes running straight to the ring. And so Bass was covering his opponent. He had given him the stampede and the ref was counting him out. And when Bass stood up and he had his hand raised, Bob was behind him like Bass had been behind Bob a few days earlier. And he did just about the same thing Bass done to him. He put a sleeper on Bass right there. Bass was just standing right there for him. He slapped a sleeper on him, and boy, the studio crowd exploded. And then when he finally laid him down, he stood over top of him and he dusted his hands off like, I'm done with you. And he just left the ring. And he passed by Charlie Sitt. And when he did, he says, there's my comment.
Okay, there you go. That's how you end that. All right, but wait. Did Bob even wake him up?
No, he didn't. I mean, you know, that wasn't like Bob. I mean, he was really, really mad at Bass, you know, and he didn't even wake him up. So here, Big C, both the Big C's and Mongolian Stomper, they come running out of the dressing room, and they get in the ring, and they're trying to get Bass awake, and they're screaming at Charlie, you know, what the heck's going on here, man? You know, so it was a little bit of a wild finish to the first match.
Wild. Yeah. You're talking some major chaos. And I tell you what, that is how a great TV show opens up. All right. So what was next, Stud?
Well, Big C 1 and 2, you know, they were the new tag team champions, and they came to the set with Charlie. Even though they weren't on the format to be there, and then Big C had a penchant for doing this on practically every show because he knew it got under Charlie's skin, right? And both of them, Big C 1 and 2, were screaming about what just happened to Ron Bass and how can Bob Armstrong leave a guy he could have died and You know, they so Charlie just ignored him. You know, and he told the ring announcer to announce the next match. And so the next match was Joe LeDuc and Robert Fuller. And they were going to be the first challengers for these Big C 1 and 2. And the studio crowd roared their approval, man, to the new team. That Rob was over and Joe LeDuc was certainly over. And both the Big C's, about the time that the announcement was done, they started bragging about their fantastic victory. And their first try at winning the belts for Bob Armstrong and Joe LeDuc. And that, after just watching how they'd won the tag belts, Charlie wasn't in the mood for Big C celebration. And so he didn't have anything to say to him the entire match. And they just rambled on and on from one subject and one topic to another, basically talking to each other and leaving Charlie out. And Charlie didn't want to be involved anyway. So Joe and Rob, they worked on their partners. They had been partners many times in the old Knoxville territory and a great team. They made a great team together. So they both finished the match. Joe got a bear hug on his guy. Rob put a Fuller leg lock on the other, and the fans showed their approval. Rob and Joe went back to the bleachers as soon as they won the match. They didn't go to the dressing room. They just crawled out on the opposite side of the ring. They went right up into the bleachers with all the fans.
So they celebrate with the fans for a little while. All right. Let's go to the always exciting personality profile. So who was on that?
Tony Charles and Jerry Stubbs, man. And they were two of the four guys on this upcoming card that were going to be in Lose or Leave matches. So Charlie made them, both of them, obviously, to make promise him that they were going to keep their cool on the set. He wanted to have them both on there at the same time. And then he showed a reel, man, that we were starting to do this kind of thing. This was a video, fantastic, classic, 5-minute long highlight reel of some of the greatest spots in the last four matches that these guys had against each other. And that they had been swapping that United States Junior Heavyweight Championship belt back and forth between the two of them during the course of this. So it was a great 5 minutes of video. I mean, wow, it was unbelievable. Then they came back to them, both of them sitting there, and then they revealed that they got to talking about this loser leave match, and they both revealed that they had neither one of them had ever lost a loser leave match in any territory. So, then they jumped to the announcement that Charlie had made on the opening of the TV show about the world junior heavyweight champion, Les Thornton, coming back to defend his title. They heard that opening thing as Charlie opened the show. And Stubbs told Charlie, you know, that he had gotten the chance. That he said to Charlie, he said, you know, Charlie, if I had gotten the chance that Tony Charles here did 3 weeks ago against Thornton, he said, I'd be the world champion already right now. And he says, and then he says to Tony, he says, and Tony over there, he could have this hunk of junk belt that I got here. And he held up the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship belt. Wow. Like it was a piece of trash. And he says, you know, and he says to Charles, he says, and after you lose this upcoming loser leaves match to me, mm-hmm. and I go ahead and beat Thornton for the World Junior Heavyweight Championship belt, he says, I'm going to send you this hunk of junk belt wherever you have to go and where you're living at, Charles.
Wow. So Stubbs actually said that about his belt.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, what an insult to Tony, man. So, and he did, you know, he showed how much he wanted to beat the world. You know, it fit for Jerry Stubbs at this point. He's a cocky son of a gun. And it just showed how much he wanted to be the world junior heavyweight champion and how much he thought he could be. And, you know, his ego had grown, man, significantly over the last couple of months since he'd turned heel. And Tony, humble as he always was, he told Stubbs, he said, you should be happy to have the belt that you're carrying there. And he says it's the last thing. If I want to, he said, if I had that belt, he goes, it would be the last thing I would want to do is to have to leave this beautiful part of the world. This is my home, he told him, man, very, very solemnly, for the last 3 years. This is my home. Mm-hmm. And he goes, I'm not going to be leaving my home. Mm-hmm. So to me, the most important and surprising thing of all in this profile is at the end of it, both of them shook hands at the end of the profile. And this was such an important match. It's a lose-or-leave match there. And it's going to change your futures. For one of these guys, they're going to have to find another territory and go. You know, I mean, I was like, wow, I can't believe that they're going to shake hands with all this riding on that match.
Wow. That really was a very serious personality profile. All right. So what was up next, Stud?
It was another, you know, a very serious subject. And the next one, Ricky Gibson, he came to the set. He still had a patch on his right eye. You know, where he'd have been hard weight the week before at the hands of Sweet Brown Sugar. And so he joined Charlie at the set to watch the match in which that happened to him, right? And it showed Brown Sugar busting into the ring and going straight for Gibson. And the punch he threw, man, you could tell, man, that's a real humdinger there. And the result of was proven. There was Ricky's eye, and he had a few stitches in it. And so if you were in the business, you could tell something wasn't right about this match, especially, you know, when Billy Spears, as soon as Brown Sugar comes in and attacks Gibson, he don't know what's going on. He just backed away into the corner and stood there next to the referee, wow, looking at him like, well, what's this all about, right?
Wow.
What's going on?
All right, so who was in the next TV match?
The next TV match was Brown Sugar. And when he got into the ring, he had a big patch on his face, too, you know. And so he had pushed, you know, Jerry Stubbs to his limit, Norvell the week before. He had to wrestle, Brown Sugar had to wrestle Norvell Austin. The week before, Jerry Stubbs had to defend the U.S. Junior title. And he defended against Norvell Austin, and wow, Norvell Austin took Stubbs to school, man. I mean, he almost beat Stubbs in that match. So Brown Sugar was a very good worker, and he had a great match with Norvell before he lost. And basically, he was working his way out of the territory, but he did it with real dignity.
That's cool. You like to hear that and see that, and sometimes it's just not the case. All right, so how about the last TV segment on this show?
Well, I was in the last match, and being introduced when Big C, uninvited again, I could see him pass by me and heading over to the set again. And he brought his Southeastern champion, the Mongolian Stomper. Stomper had his belt, and they went to the set with Charlie. And as I was taking care of business in the ring, Big C asked Charlie, you know, exactly, he said, something to the effect of, how long is it before these three world champions that Don Curtis has signed are going to be arriving here in Southeastern? Charlie didn't mention how long it was going to be until these guys got there. Charlie was still upset with Big C, man. And so he asked him, he goes, you know, why do you want to know? Right. So Big C said, you know, Big C's trying to be nice at this point, I think, and trying to get some information from Charlie, basically. And Big C says, you know, because my Mongolian Stomper is still champion. And when the NWA world champion comes, you know, he goes, the champion always wrestles the regional champion and whatever territory that is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and he says, my Stomper is a Southeastern champion. And he goes, you know, that means that he's going to get this world title match. And about that time, I won the match with my full of leg lock and in the ring, got a big roar from the crowd. So Charlie answered Big C's question. You know, he said something to the effect of, you know, if this has anything to do with your Stomper's upcoming Texas Death Championship match against Ron Fuller, the one that you happen to be barred from the ring your Mongol, he says, is going to have to beat that man. You got that just won, the one up there in the ring right now. And he says, I got to tell you, he goes, I'm going to wish you the worst of luck. And he said, and besides that, he goes, you need to leave my set immediately.
Wow. All right. Another great TV show. What about the results of the matches the following week?
Well, the first match was with Roy Lee Welch against the Super Pro. And, you know, there had not been a wrestler in Southeastern named Super Pro since January of 1980, probably 10 months earlier before the last match. And that's when the Super Pro, he lost the mass versus mass match against the extremely popular wrestling pro, Tarzan Baxter, back in January of 1980.
Yeah.
So the Super Pro, obviously, when he took his mask off, he was Randy Rhodes, right? So he had wrestled in Southeastern as Randy Rhodes since that time until he got beat by Bob Armstrong 2 weeks earlier in that Lose or Leave match. So oddly enough, 2 weeks later, after Rhodes lost this Lose or Leave match, here comes the Super Pro returning to Southeastern, right? So fans around the territory, they were nobody's fool, you know, and he certainly didn't fool anybody. And in fact, this very first night that he wrestled with his mask, the fans kept chanting, Randy Rhodes, Randy Rhodes, Randy Rhodes, letting him know that we know who you are, right?
Right.
So, and then, so it didn't bother him though, you know, Randy, he got the best of Roy Lee and Randy Rhodes had a bright future in Southeastern. He's going to become champions, one of the greatest tag teams in the history of wrestling. So Charlie Cook got another big win, literally. I call it the big win because it was against that 450-pound or so Flyboy Frazier.
Yeah, that's a big win.
That's a big win.
Yeah.
Frazier was seconded by bald-headed Floyd at that point. And in the controversial Lose or Leave match between Sweet Brown Sugar and Ricky Gibson, one that we talked about earlier, Ricky won the match, as obviously we talked about. And at the end of the week, Sweet Brown Sugar got his bonus money and he left the territory. Bob Armstrong and Ron Bass, they were like two Brahma bulls, man, battling it out, man, in this special challenge match between the two of them. Bob was really upset about what Bass had done. Now Bass was upset because Bob put him to sleep and wouldn't wake him up. And there ended up being no winner. I mean, they both got disqualified. It was just a brawl. And then the first of the three championship matches, the Big C was barred from ringside. And I finally ended up beating the Stomper for the Southeastern belt. And that kind of, I thought, gave me a leg up on everybody else with this coming match with the NWA World Champion, the new champion, Harley Race. And we're going to find out more about that as we go get into next week's Studcast.
Cool, yeah.
And then in the Southeastern Tag Championship match, the new champions, Big C, 1 and 2, they had to get disqualified to save their belts against Rob and Joe. Well, Rob and Joe were about to take the deal, and they tossed one of them over the top rope, and they kept the belts. They lost the match, but they kept the belt. Last match of the night, that was that Lose or Leave Southeastern. It was the winner of the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion was going to get, and both men were basically a bloody mess, man. Wow. But Jerry Stubbs managed to defeat Tony Charles. And Tony's run of champion, which had been off and on for basically years in both Southeastern territories, it ended the longest run in Southeastern history, man, of a guy owning that junior title belt.
Wow. And what a memorable night for those that witnessed that evening of wrestling. So how about the attendance in the three major markets? I love to hear the numbers on this.
We're all three. We're right there again, man. It's where they had been for 3 weeks in a row. I mean, this was the fourth one. And it was, you know, these were all record attendances. And if it wasn't the record, then it wasn't quite a thing. But it was just short of another record. Montgomery had had 5,300 a week before. It had 5,100, almost 53. Dothan had 55 the week before, came back and had 5,500 again. Mobile also did the same thing. They had 6,000 in Mobile, and Mobile came back with 6,000.
You know, and I'm proud to live in the Dothan area, and that's one of the things people go, what is the big deal about Dothan? And, I mean, Dothan's a small town, but that's the big deal, what you just said. Dothan's wrestling audience was at least equal or better than Montgomery, for example, by 200 spectators. 5,500 matched in some areas, and 6,000 for Mobile, only off by 500 versus Mobile. So that's why Dothan was called the hotbed of wrestling for a small town in southeast Alabama. All right, and another great studcast. Absolutely. I'm happy to say we are going to have time. Let's go with a learning tree question. We pulled this one out. Greg McMahon asked, Ron, what do you think about today's fans that think you have to have 3 months of 20-minute promos at least twice a week for a month to be considered a great match? I've actually heard people say no one really cares about what goes on in the ring. It's all about the buildup leading to the match. I also remember Harley Race saying in the old days they'd cut you off if the promo was more than 3 minutes long. All right, that's quite a detailed question from Greg. So good luck with coming up with the answer on that one.
That's a really good question, Greg. I mean, that's pretty cool, man. I don't think I ever heard that comment from Harley, but I can believe Harley would definitely say that, you know. So and I think Greg was your first name, and sorry, but I picked up more on that second name. Pretty close to McMahon, you know. And so that one, I believe the answer to your question has a lot to do with that last name, McMahon. So let's start this one, man, by going back to my father and my grandfather's time, when wrestling was truly wrestling. It was what you did in the ring that was the most important part of the sport. Matches were long and grueling, man. And the promos leading up to them, back in my granddad's day, they were non-existent. There was no television shows, and you know what, they didn't make interviews. So before wrestling started on TV in the late 1940s, promos meant nothing at all. In fact, they were never done unless you were in a building where the wrestler somehow got his hands on the announcer's microphone and then said something to his opponent across the ring from him. But that wasn't a promo. They were already going to wrestle each other, so they're not promoting any future event. So in order to bring people back to the next event during that time frame, you couldn't talk them into the building. And that's what I think happens nowadays, is they want to talk you into buying a ticket. Back in those days, in the old days, you had to wrestle them into the building, by God. You had to have such a good match that they wanted to see that match again the very next week. So drawing crowds for return matches were dependent entirely upon how good that first match against each other was. And what kind of finish they had, you know, who won, who didn't win. They created a controversy with their wrestling, not the talk. So TV's wrestling changed all of that. To begin with, when it started, wrestlers began to have short interviews, but they still had these long matches. Basically, they were telling the story. And as years went by, TV interviews got to be longer and matches got to be shorter, right? And that progression kind of led to a time when good talkers, guys that could really talk, started drawing as much as good workers and that really started to change everything. So if you fast forward to the late 1990s and to that guy named McMahon, you have what basically that you described in your question here to me, Greg. I see exactly what you're saying. Vince McMahon turned wrestling from wrestling in the ring to 3 months of 20-minute promos twice a week.
Yeah.
Ultimately, at the end of it, a meaningless match with fewer and fewer fans caring at all about who won and who was even in the ring. So it's a shame where wrestling is today, man, compared to when there was no interviews. I'm glad you mentioned Harley Race, Greg, and his statement about those promos in the good old days, that he was exactly right. I mean, in the good old days, they limited. In fact, your interviews were normally limited to a 2-minute segment. And if you went 3 minutes, you were way past when you were supposed to have stopped talking.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was another day and time. So, and I'm also happy that you mentioned Harley in this, Greg, because earlier in this studcast, I happened to be covering the Southeastern Territories in 1980. In this studcast here. So I believe basically the 1980s were probably the best decade in professional wrestling history. And it's simple, really, why I say that, because I think that we had the perfect mix back in 1980s of talk and action in the ring for television. Thanks a lot, Greg. That's a great question, man. And I hope I've answered some of it, or if not all of it, that you asked.
Oh, dude, I called you dude. I think you nailed it. You absolutely nailed it. And I appreciate Greg's mention of the legend Harley Race, rest his soul. To me, that era, when you've got somebody like Harley Race, who is the king sitting on the throne, and everybody recognizes, he is, what was the saying? He's the baddest man on God's green earth. Did I get it right?
That's it.
Oh, when you start talking about the matches, the interaction that you had, and then in that story, I'd love to hear the stories about the legendary Harley Race. You've done it again, Ron. I love that answer. It is so true. You've taken us in all directions today, and it seems like that has become the new standard for these studcasts. So I don't know how you're going to top it, but where are you going to ride next week on this thing?
Well, right now we're in such a great time period for Southeastern down there on the Gulf Coast. And we're talking about those triple world title matches that announced by Charlie at the beginning of this TV show. Those matches are going to start happening in the next two studcasts. In fact, in the not next studcast, but the one after that is going to be one of those triple world championship events. So my win over Stomper in this studcast should have instantly given me the world title match with Harley. But the champion's influence, which I had no no idea this was the case, the champion's influence, Harley's influence on Don Curtis was going to change this whole deal where the champion automatically gets to wrestle Harley.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, in fact, the next week's card and the next studcast is going to be one of the best in history, and it's going to be basically a tournament to see who wrestles the champion rather than the champion wrestling the champion. So the situation, my brother is in at this point. He's been offered the Georgia booking job by Jim Barnett. We're going to talk about the rest of that next week. I mean, it's a total shock. This thing was a total shock to me. You know, Rob says, Ron, Jim Barnett wants me to be the booker in Georgia. I mean, what in the heck? So we're going to get to the bottom of all that next week. Plus, we got another great TV show and hopefully another learning tree question, too.
Well, there you go. You've already got it set up for another jam-packed show. On Facebook, folks, you know how to get up with Ron. You find Ron at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. Like and follow him there. Automatically become friends with a living legend. Twitter or X, it's Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow him there also. Check out the fantastic website, tnstud.com. tnstud.com. This studcast will be there. Every studcast ever done. The stud store is there too, where you can get 43 super studcasts, 4 different 8x10 photos, the best-selling novel, Brutus, personally autographed to you. You can subscribe to Ron's YouTube channel, Southeastern Rewind. Find hundreds of hours of classic old-school wrestling entertainment, 444 total videos, the last 147 studcasts, Ask the Stud shows, and Short Rides with the Stud are there too. Go back 1 year or more and discover fantastic stud stories with worldwide stars. Studcast archive stories. Tell me more fan question shows. Superstars of the past and so much more. That's YouTube. Southeastern Rewind. It's the best deal in wrestling. Bar none. Any final comments today, Stud?
Well, our prayers obviously go out to those affected, and not only in Hurricane Helene, but at this point in Hurricane Milton as well, man. I'm hoping for the best for people in both those areas. And please take care of yourselves and others, and may God bless us all.
Very well said, Stud. For Ron Fuller in the great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me on Facebook at facebook.com/dsummers955. On Twitter, now known as X, Dave_Doin. On Instagram, it's instagram.com/DavidSummersProductions. And hit me up anytime at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud, LLC.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the great Smoky Mountains.